From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The historically Republican stronghold of Georgia turned a shade of blue last night, with Democrats winning a coveted Senate seat. Reverend Raphael Warnock beat Republican incumbent Kelly Loeffler. He will become the first black senator to represent the state. And the second Senate race between Democrat John Ossoff and Republican David Perdue, which could give Democrats the majority in the Senate, is still too close to call.
But no matter the outcome of that race, what remains clear is that Georgia politics has changed course in big part because of grassroots organizing. Here's Raphael Warnock earlier on Morning Edition.
This is an electorate that has become increasingly diverse. It's the result of work we've been doing for about a decade now. We've registered hundreds of thousands of voters in this state.
Brittany Whaley is one of those organizers. She's a political strategist with the Working Families Party. And for the last year, Brittany has been on the ground organizing, and she joins us now from Atlanta, Georgia. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Brittany, an early CNN exit poll shows that 93% of black voters in Georgia support Democratic challengers Ossoff and Warnock. What does Raphael Warnock's win mean to you? And what does it really say about the changes in Georgia's electorate?
Yeah, so it is very exciting, and the numbers don't lie. Black voters, we showed up. And what it really says is, like, we have someone who, you know, for me, I have someone who I believe will fight for the issues that matter most to my community. So when we go to the polls, we take our issues to the polls. That is what motivates us. And so whether you're talking about moving closer to healthcare, universal healthcare, or you're talking about relief, and which right now is huge, right? Relief during a time when a lot of people are struggling. Like, those are things that really matter to us. And that's something that I feel was lacking. Quite frankly, there was a lack of leadership in our representation with Perdue and Loeffler that we now will have. I feel confident that we have people who will go and fight for us.
This is a really interesting point to make, a note to make, that it was because of the issues that brought folks to the polls. We've been talking quite a bit about how organizations like yours, the Working Families Party, has been organizing since Stacey Abrams ran for governor in 2017. You're originally from Las Vegas, Nevada, but you say that, like many black folks, you have chosen to move back to the South and call Atlanta home. And this, of course, is a real demographic shift that many are calling the new Great Migration. How is this movement changing Southern politics? Are we partly seeing that now?
Yeah, so I think two things, right? There are some black folks who migrated to other places. My people are originally from Louisiana. They moved west, and now I'm coming back south. And then there are some black folks who have stayed in the South. And the people who have stayed in the South, you see a through line of continued organizing, right? And a resilience and a fight for our seat at the table, and quite frankly, a fight for our democracy. So I really want to couch it in that too, right? So I think that there's like a demographic shift. People are moving to Georgia, like demographics of people of color. You know, clearly we're becoming closer to a majority. And I think, yes, that is one piece of it. But the numbers alone don't get us there. There's a lot of organizing that has happened to make sure that we are creating the coalition that we need and that we're fighting, again, for those issues that are most important to us. So I think it's both and. It's people who have been here, who have been fighting, who have been, you know, at this for decades, right? And it's folks who are moving here, all coming together with white progressives and a multiracial coalition that's going to push us forward and really center some of our most vulnerable communities, people who hold marginalized identities, and saying that, no, you are not disposable, right? You matter in this democracy. Your issues matter. And this is how we work together, and we decide collectively to take back our democracy.
Brittany, we've got to talk another time. I am out of time with you, but thank you so much. That's Brittany Whaley, electoral strategist and organizer with the Working Families Party. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
From Georgia to Capitol Hill, where a joint session of Congress is meeting to officially declare Joe Biden the winner of the presidential election. Biden won 306 electoral votes, so normally this would be a ceremonial event. But today, about a dozen Republican senators and many more House Republicans are expected to object to the certification of the vote, which will trigger hours and hours of debate. One of them is Florida Republican Michael Waltz. He joined us before the session began. You've indicated that you plan to object to the certification of the Electoral College votes today, even though, Congressman, you know, the math doesn't work out. Republicans don't have the numbers they need to block those votes. So what's the goal? Why are you doing this?
Yeah, sure. I'm doing some, and I'm objecting to some, but not all. The distinction in my mind is there were allegations of fraud, criminal fraud, that has to be proven in court. And in some of the states, that has not been proven. What I am focused on are the constitutional issues at play. The Equal Protection Clause in the 14th Amendment is validated by Bush versus Gore, where counties can't treat ballots differently. In some counties in Pennsylvania, voters were allowed to cure and to fix their mail-in ballots, and some they were not. So there are some real constitutional issues that we need to shine a spotlight on that my constituents have asked me to object to. I do not buy into the notion that this is overturning election or treason or sedition or a lot of those terms, frankly, that are insulting. At the end of it, we'll have, I'm confident, a president-elect and a peaceful transfer of power.
So let's clear it up. You say it's insulting to you, but you brought it up. A lot of people are wondering whether or not this is an effort or worried that this is an effort to overturn the election, the will of the American people. And at the very least, skeptics would say you're making a political statement by showing loyalty to the president, that your intentions aren't as pure here as you say they are.
Yeah, I think my 24 years of service fighting for this Constitution and now continued service here, I shouldn't have to defend my motives or my character. And that's a sad state, frankly, for journalism and the media that go to personal attacks and character attacks. I'm stating my objections and my interpretation of the Constitution, and that's okay. In 2005, when both the Senate and the House objected to Bush's election, you know, that resulted in a commission led by Jimmy Carter. And I think we need to, you know, continue to improve our elections going forward.
Well, here's what's confusing to people, though. The spotlight you refer to has already been shining on this issue. Since the election, there have been weeks and weeks and 60 court cases to present evidence of fraud or wrongdoing in this election. All 50 states have certified the votes. No one has been able to present any credible evidence. Do you not have faith in the justice system or in your fellow Republicans who are leading many of these states?
But I think you're conflating two things. Criminal allegations have to be proven. Those are handled in the courts. Constitutional issues, you know, are perfectly within our purview. And so, for example, in 2001, when the election went through the Supreme Court twice, Democrats still objected with the certification of the electors.
Al Gore gaveled them down because he thought it was bad for the country.
No, that's inaccurate, frankly. He gaveled them down because he said you do not have a senator that's also objecting. In 2005, they did, and Nancy Pelosi supported that. So this is our system. It's been used multiple times. I'm frankly a little perplexed at yours and others kind of hyperventilating about it. This is our democracy at work.
But Congressman, you know it's not just me, as you say, hyperventilating or asking you questions. It's not just journalists. Your own conservative colleagues in Congress, many of them disagree with you. Congressman Chip Roy said the text of the Constitution is clear. States select electors. Congress does not.
That's right.
Look at the Senate, where it's even stronger. James Inhofe, a very conservative senator, said it would be a violation of his oath of office to go through with this. Kevin Cramer said it would go against his conscience.
Sure.
This is causing a rift
in your
party.
What I was referring to was some of your colleagues. I don't want to pretend to say that you said this, of calling, you know, people have a different opinion than Congressman Roy, who I respect very much, extremists, radicals. That's what I find, frankly, very insulting. And you know what? Disagreement's okay.
You don't think it's causing a rift in your party?
We've had disagreement when it comes to the role of federalism. This law that we are enacting, the Electoral Count Act, has been taken to the courts multiple times and upheld. This isn't historic or unprecedented.
It is unprecedented in one way, at least, because President Trump, a president, is calling into question the results of an election. I just want to understand if you think that and what you're doing is causing a rift in your party. Look at Georgia last night. At least one and likely two Democrats are going to be going to the U.S. Senate. Many believe that this effort to call the election into question is what led to those results.
I think you had historic African-American turnout. I think they had a fantastic ground game to continue to turn out the vote. It looks like they ran a better election. What I'm concerned about, if they want to put Democratic policies or progressive policies forward, that's absolutely their right. But if they want to put fundamental changes, the Electoral College, new states, that has me really concerned. We'll see how the rest of this election goes with Purdue.
Congressman Michael Waltz, thank you so much.
Hey, thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
American political history is being written today. On the National Mall, President Trump addressed his supporters, many members of the far-right political groups, and falsely claimed that he won the election. He told them he would never concede, and he again put pressure on Vice President Mike Pence to overturn Joe Biden's win by sending the election back to the states, which Pence does not have the power to do. Mike Pence right now is presiding over a joint session of Congress to formally certify the Electoral College vote count. Here's President Trump.
And Mike Pence is going to have to come through for us, and if he doesn't, that will be a sad day for our country. Because you're sworn to uphold our Constitution.
Well, as President Trump was speaking, Vice President Pence released a statement saying that while he would give a fair and open hearing to Republicans objecting to the vote, he cannot claim unilateral authority to throw out votes. Our next two guests join 20 other historians in calling out efforts to challenge the vote as, quote, nothing but sheer political grandstanding and a danger to democracy. Benil Joseph is founding director of Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at the University of Texas at Austin. And Elizabeth Cobbs is professor of American history at Texas A&M University and a visiting scholar at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Yes. So let's put today into context. I'll start with you, Benil. How do you view today's events?
Well, I think it's juxtaposed. This is a tremendous day for American democracy in the aftermath of both the November elections and yesterday's two Senate runoffs in Georgia. And we have the first black senator elect from the state of Georgia in American history. There's really only been two who've been elected by the popular vote, Tim Scott from South Carolina, and now Reverend Raphael Warnock. Hiram Revels and Blanche K. Bruce represented Mississippi during Reconstruction when senators weren't elected by the popular vote. And there's been very, very few African-Americans elected in the 20th century, starting with Edward Brooke in Massachusetts in 1966, all the way up to Carolyn Moseley Braun in Illinois, and then, of course, Senator Barack Obama and Kamala Harris as well. So it's a historic day. I think what's going on right now, something that should be pro forma in terms of the ratification of the Electoral College and these conspiracy theories and the president sort of gathering a mob in the nation's capital to oppose a legally decided election is really, really tragic and sad. But I think we should not undermine the success of people organizing and people really trying to exercise their democratic rights by just focusing on these efforts to undermine the democratic process.
Professor Cobbs, your thoughts on this? I mean, what Peniel is saying is not to let the challenge of the vote in Congress overshadow this success.
Well, I love an optimist. So, I mean, I think that is a very worthwhile way to look at it. But I also think it's important to just, you know, it's sort of like if you're in a car, almost in a car crash, and you come close to the edge of a drop-off, it makes you appreciate what you've got. And I think that that need to appreciate what we have is absolutely fundamental to our democracy. I'm always reminded of George Washington's farewell address, where that's where he starts. He says, you know, we are easily distracted because of our differences from what really counts, which is to appreciate this democracy we have. But he also warned that the one thing that could destroy it for us all is partisanship, which he always sort of said, you know, there's partisanship and there's patriotism. I mean, he talks about it in the same paragraph, and he says, you know, one will lead us down a bad road. And so I think that this is a great moment to sort of say, okay, it's precedent is important because precedent is about trust and trusting in our institutions rather than trying to tear them down, which is what the president has done, even by challenging his own vice president and saying the vice president has a power which the vice president does not have. So he's just making stuff up. And, you know, I think that it's very important to just look at it in a clear-eyed way and to know that we have to take care against that.
Oh, Professor Cobb, the question I have is about precedent. What does this mean for the election 2 years from now? What does it mean for the election 4 years from now, even further down the road? You have so many things happening that are just challenging anything we've ever known to happen in American history. What do you think about the precedent that this is setting?
Oh, I think that's a really great question, Peter, because, you know, every moment in a way is a precedent. We had the, you know, the Civil War, right? The precedent of people who at that time were called fire eaters. Those are the people who were trying to tear down the system and shed doubt on the American system. And they led to a terrible war. But it's also sometimes when you come to these critical elections in American history where people of substance say, okay, listen, it's not about partisanship. Thomas Jefferson did that in 1800, which was a very contested election. And, you know, in his inaugural address said, okay, now's when we come back together. We're all, and that using the party terms at the time, we're all Federalists, we're all Republicans, as they were called then. And I think we have to do that now. So you're right. You're absolutely right. It's a big heads up. Is this how people are going to act from here on out? Or are people going to use this as a lesson learned? And, of course, I like the optimistic approach that we need to think of it as a lesson learned rather than as a way to be.
So let's ask the optimist, Peniel Joseph. You heard the president there say in that cut that it's a sad day for our country because Mike Pence is sworn to uphold the Constitution. You know, he's saying if he doesn't refute the vote, right? And really what Mike Pence will likely do today is uphold the Constitution by not refuting the vote. And we heard earlier in the show, Republican Congressman Michael Waltz say that this is not about trying to overturn the election. This is just about exercising our rights. What do you think about that, those arguments?
Well, I think this really is connected to the nation's original sin of racial slavery. And if we go back to Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural, which is really one of the best inaugural addresses in American history, there's a point where he says, "Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away." But he says, "Yet if God wills that it continue until all the wealth piled by the bondsman's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with the sword, as was said 3,000 years ago, so still it must be said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether." What he meant by that was that what happened during the Civil War happened because of the immorality of racial slavery and the dehumanization of Black people's bodies. And right now, what's happening with this Jim Crow caucus attempting to decertify this election is the continuation of that scourge of war by other means in 2021. And we've seen the political reckoning of last year is the further continuation of that war by other means. So I'm an optimist, but I'm also a realist. I understand that at the heart of the matter is, do Black people count as human beings within the democracy that they helped to create? And when we think about what happened with Reverend Warnock and what perhaps might happen with John Ossoff, we owe a tremendous debt to these Black women like Stacey Abrams, the Black women players of the WNBA who had shirts saying vote for Warnock when he was polling at under 9%. Black people continue to love this country and show a loyalty to the purpose and the foundations of our democracy, even when the nation steadfastly, stubbornly, perniciously refuses to love us back. So the point of today is to do two things. To, yes, acknowledge that we are in precipitously dangerous times when we have one major party that doesn't believe in American democracy. But we should also revel and acknowledge in the fact that we have in the great state of Georgia the first Black senator who's going to be elected to the Senate, who really ran on a platform that was connected to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s beloved community, a community that was free of racial injustice, economic inequality, and violence. So we are coming closer in certain ways to not just perfecting the union, but really reimagining American democracy that is multiracial, that's multicultural, that's anti-racist, and that is centered on justice and democracy for all people, irrespective of their backgrounds, their religions, their economic status, or anything. So those are the things that we should focus on. And when we think about Abraham Lincoln, Lincoln is so transformative, and so is King, and so are people like Stacey Abrams, because they believe in small d democracy. They believe in the country, even when elected officials and at times ordinary citizens don't want to believe in the country. So I'm optimistic always because we're standing on the shoulders of these titans who bled for democracy, not just overseas, but right here in Texas, where I live, New York, where I'm from, nationally, because they thought that we had a great opportunity in the United States of America to be liberty's surest guardian because we believed in human rights for all people.
Man, I had a whole lot of questions for both of you guys, but I can't, I have no other questions except for, I want Peter to actually take it from here. We have 30 seconds.
Professor Cobbs, just quickly, because we only have 30 seconds here.
I think this also goes back to ancient Rome. I mean, I think Peniel is absolutely correct, but it also goes back to the problem of demagoguery. And Hamilton was killed for opposing a man who wanted to do exactly what Donald Trump is trying to do, which is to undermine an election.
Elizabeth Cobbs and Peniel Joseph, both historians, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And on this very busy day in Washington, there's breaking news about President-elect Joe Biden's cabinet. NPR is reporting that Biden will name Federal Appeals Court Judge Merrick Garland to be his nominee to be Attorney General. Garland was picked by then-President Obama as a nominee for the Supreme Court back in 2016. But you'll remember, Republicans who controlled the Senate blocked his nomination from ever being considered. Carrie Johnson covers the Justice Department for NPR, and she joins us now. Carrie, big day, big news. What more do we know about this nomination?
Yeah, big news indeed. Merrick Garland, I think, had been a favorite of some people close to President-elect Joe Biden for some time. They were taken by the story of what happened after Watergate, former University of Chicago President Edward Leavy came to run the Justice Department after a period of great tumult and helped try to restore confidence. The idea among the Biden team now is that Merrick Garland, who's known as a nonpartisan figure, a not polarizing figure, and somebody with deep roots inside the Justice Department, including managing cases and then involving the Unabomber and the Oklahoma City bombing, that he could restore some confidence in the workforce and public confidence after just some very chaotic years in the Trump era.
It is an interesting choice because right now Merrick Garland is in a nonpartisan job. He's a judge, right? And he will now, if he accepts this and is confirmed, he would be thrust into a job that has become in recent years sort of the center of the political world. How do you think he'll handle that transition?
You are so right. The environment, the stove could not be hotter, but Merrick Garland is really known as a guy who can cool temperaments. He is not somebody who has an affinity to fly off the handle. And in fact, he's attracted some support from Republicans on Capitol Hill. People like Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, Mike Lee of Utah, Susan Collins of Maine, and others have been supportive of Merrick Garland in the past for a number of positions, including a float of an FBI director earlier, and when Lawmakers were asked about Merrick Garland on Biden's shortlist. They all said two thumbs up. So the big question, I think, for the Biden team was that if Merrick Garland were to leave a lifetime appointed judgeship, would the Senate confirm someone to succeed him there? Given the results in Georgia and the way things appear to be heading, that's less of a concern for Democrats now.
I know this news is early and still just breaking, but what's the word at the Justice Department? Have you heard anything?
Morale has been very bad at the Justice Department. The notion that Merrick Garland and Biden's likely nominee to be Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco, the likely nominee for Associate AG Vinita Gupta, all three of those people have deep roots inside the Justice Department. That could help quiet some of the concerns we've heard from inside DOJ over the last 4 years, for sure.
Interesting to note, another one of the names that had been floated here was the former Alabama Senator Doug Jones. Looks like he either will not get this job or maybe there'll be another place for him in the administration, but we will just have to see. What's next, quickly?
Yeah, Doug Jones is a close friend of Joe Biden, but the issue was it may not have been the right call to bring somebody in directly from Capitol Hill to run a Justice Department that appears to have been politicized in the Trump era. What's next is we're going to have some confirmation hearings in January or February and a new Justice Department leadership team.
2021 is getting off to quite a start already. Carrie Johnson from NPR, thank you so much for your time.
Happy to do it.
And this January, did you make a New Year's resolution to lose weight, eat more superfoods, or get more exercise? Those are all good things to do. But science writer Martha Zaroska argues, in terms of living longer, they probably won't help you as much as improving your connections to other people. In fact, relationships, volunteering, and simple acts of kindness can help with the process of growing young. That's the title of her new book. And Martha Zaroska joins us now via Skype to talk about it. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Tonya.
So there's a lot of data in your book, and like any good journalist, you went on this quest to get scientific answers. Let's talk for a moment about the science behind your argument that human contact is more beneficial than, say, getting more exercise. You illustrate this by explaining how the mind communicates with the body, especially when we're under stress. Say more.
So, you know, humans are social apes. We evolved to be surrounded by others of our tribe. And this is when our bodies function the best. When you think about it, you know, in our evolutionary past, when we were alone, it usually meant that we were alone on the savannah, so potentially facing lots of dangers, all the lions and accidents that could happen to us. And as such, we were in a state of stress. So our bodies adapted to recognize whether we are safe with others, or maybe they should be preparing for accidents, for predators, and so on and so on. So we have lots of different systems in our body. For example, the fight or flight response, the HPA axis, so-called the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, that starts with the signal in your brain that tells you that there is a reason to be stressed, and then sends all this soup of hormones throughout your body, basically one triggering another and so on and so on. And all these hormones prepare your body to fight and to face all those dangers when you are alone. The problem is that these days our stressors are very, very different. We are chronically stressed by things such as mortgages, you know, school reports and traffic and work issues. And all these systems, so the HPA axis, the sympathetic nervous system as well, they're chronically activated.
When you say chronically activated, what you mean is that it is basically all the time where we're in this fight or flight, or the HPA axis is activated. And that does something very specific to our bodies.
Exactly. All these hormones such as cortisol, you know, the stress hormone or adrenaline, they keep flooding our bodies the whole time. And with all the detrimental downstream effects, such as, for example, higher risk of diabetes or cardiovascular disease. And at the same time, you know, what we also get from being with other people are so-called social hormones. So things such as oxytocin or serotonin, endorphins, vasopressin, which both make us feel trusting and connected to other people, but also have very real downstream effects on our health.
So social connection helps improve our hormone levels. And you give several examples, but there's one, the Rosetto effect. This is an actual place where the death rate at one time was about 35% lower than the general population. They weren't particularly healthy people by Western standards, but you're saying they had deep social connections.
Yes. So basically nobody was dying of heart attacks in Rosetto, which started really attracting attention of scientists and doctors back in the 1960s. And what they have discovered exactly was that it was not the diet. It was not any other lifestyle habits, because they were smoking, they were drinking, you know, and they also didn't have anything particular in their genes. But what was special about the place was the community. So people there, for example, had 22 civic organizations, even though there were only 2,000 inhabitants. They were constantly meeting each other. They were constantly visiting neighbors. They were really taking care of their public space, having parties, volunteering, helping each other out. And most likely this was what caused this amazing health of the inhabitants. And what the doctors and researchers back then also predicted, that were they to ever abandon their ways, their health would deteriorate as well. And unfortunately, this is exactly what happened generations later in the 70s and 80s and so on. And when people started pursuing, you know, the so-called American dream and living in the suburbs, buying cars, working longer hours, and they stopped being so connected to their community, their health also just went back to American average.
But Martha, this is especially resonant to me because it got me thinking about church groups during this pandemic who have argued that they are essential because they offer a deep sense of community. I mean, we learned from your book that human connection is not just a human want, it's a human need. And all I could think in reading your book is, how do we do this when we can't do it in the traditional ways we used to right now? Is this social isolation shortening all of our lives?
I'm hopeful that it's not, because it's quite a temporary state. You know, if it was something that we had to live with for years, I would be much more worried. It is true that we need the connection, and, you know, that loneliness has very serious detrimental effects on our health. People who are lonely have higher blood pressure. They have even different gene expression when it comes to cancer, for instance. So it is a very serious issue. But on the other hand, you know, there are ways to still connect. Even in pandemic times, you know, you can call, you can volunteer online as well, for instance, which is an amazing way to also boost your health through connection and helping others. You can engage in acts of kindness, which is another thing that is very important for our health. Mm-hmm. You can try to look for meaning in life, another thing which really is connected to our health and longevity.
You mentioned kindness, but we can't overstate it. I mean, in your book, you note that kindness, as well as experiencing empathy, is an important part of keeping healthy. And you actually went through an experiment that showed performing simple acts of kindness actually changes hormone levels.
Yes, I tried to replicate other research that was conducted on hundreds of subjects. And I've done it with collaboration with scientists from University College London, King's College London. And what they helped me do was measure my levels of stress hormone cortisol. And we've done it for 7 days, morning, afternoon, and evening. And on some of the days, I performed acts of kindness. So I would sit in the morning and prepare a list of all the nice things I could do for people. And then on other days, I would just live my life as usual. And when the results came in, we were really surprised to see that you could really clearly see which days were my kindness days, because my levels of cortisol were very much different. They were much, you could say, better on the days when I engaged in kindness, no matter how stressful the actual days were for me.
This is remarkable. Let's slow it down, because what you're saying is that there were measurable differences in the day-to-day. We're not talking over time. You can actually change your levels based on what you do for others in any given day.
Totally. We could really see it on my cortisol. And, you know, there was an actual proper research study done in California where people were randomized to conduct acts of kindness, whereas the control group wasn't doing anything. And they could see the differences in actual gene expression of those people in their white blood cells that were less tuned towards inflammation if they were doing kindness. And we know that inflammation is something that's really detrimental to our health long term. And they were also not doing anything huge, just like me. You know, the acts of kindness they were engaging in were, for example, buy a coffee for a stranger or let others ahead of you in traffic. Really, really small things. And you could see it on the level of gene expression. So this is really, really not only fascinating, but, you know, how physiological it all is.
Before I let you go, we have to talk about dietary fads. And to those fads, you basically say, ditch the goji berries and take vitamins in moderation. I mean, this is so against what we've been told for so long. What's your takeaway message?
I mean, certainly don't ditch goji berries if you really like them, if you eat them for yes. the flavor. It's perfectly fine. I like them myself. But it's correct that from a perspective of an average person, someone who is obsessed about their health, following all the fad diets and running every day and so on and so on, but also lonely and pessimistic and never engaging in any social life or volunteering and so on, compared to another person who is very optimistic and engaged in their community and having lots of friends, but perhaps not eating so healthy, it's really hard to say who will live longer, but it's possible that it may be the couch potato who is surrounded by loving others. So, you know, we have to really recognize how important these connections are for our health. And of course, the best scenario is when you are socially connected and optimistic and you eat healthy and exercise. But if something had to give, completely giving up on your social life is not a good health strategy.
Marta Zaraska's book is Growing Young, How Friendship, Optimism, and Kindness Can Help You Live to 100. Marta, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Tonya.
A year ago, when a cluster of mysterious pneumonia cases appeared in Wuhan, China, infectious disease experts and reporters took notice. Helen Branswell was one of the first. On January 4th, 2020, she reported on the outbreak, which appeared to be caused by a new coronavirus. Helen is the infectious disease and global health reporter for our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication, and she joins us now, as she has many times over the course of this year. Helen, thanks for being here.
No, thanks for having me.
And looking back a year ago, what were your first thoughts as you saw those pneumonia cases emerge in Wuhan? Did you understand the gravity of the situation?
So I first saw that something was going on there on Christmas Eve. I saw something on a listserv that I subscribed to that was talking about unexplained pneumonias in China. And yeah, I did know that that meant something to be watched. I had covered the 2003 SARS outbreak, and I didn't know for sure that it was going to be this big. I thought that there was a possibility that whatever was going on might be controlled, but I did know that it was something the world was going to need to pay attention to.
Mm. At what point did you realize it would turn into a pandemic or be as big as it ended up being?
You know, I actually can't pinpoint for myself when I thought, oh, yeah, this is definitely it. But I do recall having this conversation on January 24th with a scientist named Trevor Bedford, who's at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Institute in Seattle. At the time, people like Trevor were using sequences to try to gauge how many cases might have emerged outside of the borders of China. And they were using sort of this rule of thumb that if there was one exported case, that probably meant there'd been 500 that you hadn't seen. And he was talking to me about that, and he said something about 13 exported cases. And I said, oh, no, the number's gone up. It's 29. And he muttered this word that I can't repeat here. And I said, did you just say? And he said, yeah, if this isn't controlled quickly, we're looking at a pandemic. And, you know, that was January 24th.
How did that feel to hear that news?
It was unsettling. I called my editor, and he remembers how anxious I sounded. It was a very odd time, sort of late January, mid-February. The world was really slow to react. And I couldn't really understand why the world was reacting so slowly, because, you know, it seemed really abundantly clear that the virus was going to do outside of China what it had done in China. And it has.
So was that the thing that surprised you the most about this pandemic, the way that the world has responded to it? I mean, what, fast forward 12 months, what's been the thing that's kind of shocked you or surprised you about the way this has developed?
You know, I don't know that I can pinpoint one thing, but there are several interlocked things. You know, there was the slowness of the response. I was very surprised that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention botched the testing right off the start. That really put the country behind the eight ball. And, you know, anybody can make a mistake, but it was a terrible time to make a mistake. And the politicization of the outbreak, you know, it never occurred to me that people would deny the existence of what was happening because of the way they voted or who they supported politically. I mean, people still insist that this is a hoax. I don't understand how to, like, I cannot comprehend that.
You make a good point. And people are also saying, well, thank goodness 2020 is over and 2021 is going to be better. That may be true. But this thing is not over. So what keeps you awake at night when you think about the work that you'll be doing in the year ahead?
Well, obviously, you know, the new strains, the variants that have emerged in South Africa and the United Kingdom, which seem to be quite a bit more transmissible, are really worrying, because that could just speed everything up. I mean, you know, if more people become infected, the same percentage of severe cases will tip health systems over. They're already struggling. So there's that. There's the fatigue. You know, everybody is very tired of this and really wants it to be over. And, you know, when you combine that with the rollout of vaccines, don't get me wrong, the rollout of vaccines is really hopeful. But, you know, it's going to take quite a while to vaccinate the country and the world, even longer. And everybody's tired, but this is not a time to let down one's guard.
Helen Branswell, infectious disease and global health reporter for STAT. Helen, thank you for all the work you've been doing in this past year. But, and by the way, do you happen to know how many stories you've written in the past 12 months?
My editor said the other day that I'd written 147 on COVID. I'm not sure about that, but I can tell you that I've written about three in the past 12 months that weren't about COVID. It's been all COVID all the time.
Well, thank you for doing that.
Thanks for having me.
Stories. That's a lot for people keeping track at home. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.